I am an alcoholic. My name is Jane.
My name is
Jane. And by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since the 18th of September, 1996, which for this alcoholic is a real miracle. No one announced themselves as a newcomer, but if there are any newcomers, or if anyone's feeling new, welcome. Welcome home. I hope this is where you find home, because I did. I always like to start with a little something from the book, because then I know you'll hear at least one true thing from me today. The doctor's opinion describes me perfectly. And in the third edition, that's on Roman numerals, page 26 and 27, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomena of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules, which may be my fundamental problem anyway. I couldn't follow a rule if my life depended on it. I'm glad we have suggestions here. My good friend Al Easthouse used to say, yeah, we call them suggestions, but it really means you pretty damn well ought to. So I do that too. And I did. I got sober in California, what seems like almost a lifetime ago. I lived in California because my mom moved there after I graduated high school. I went to college. She moved to California to be close to family. I flunked out of my first college that I went to, mainly because I was a kid who grew up in the 60s, and fundamentally, I am restless, irritable, and discontented. That is my nature. And because I'm restless, irritable, and discontented, I need a way to fix that. And because I am a kid of the 60s, I knew exactly how to fix that. And that's the end of that story. And so the university said, you probably ought to go somewhere else because you aren't coming back here. So I went to California figuring I'd get a free place to live. And I'd find myself. And my mom asserted that I would pay rent and I would go to work. And so I did that. And I swore I'd never go to California because I had applied to schools to go to college in California, but I didn't really want to go there because it was California. And I was born and raised in Colorado, and that was California. So I ended up there anyway. And I went to school, and I worked, and I worked, and I went to school, and I got involved in high tech, and I worked at a lot of startup companies, and startup companies are wonderful places, particularly in the 70s and 80s, because they had lots of money, and the refrigerators were full of not just food, but pretty much anything you could possibly want. The parking lots were crazy at lunchtime, and it was a big party. And if you wanted to party, you could, and if you wanted to work, you could, and sometimes you did both. The truth is that I spent a lot of time working those 12 to 16 hour days, 6 to 7 days a week, doing really exciting things, hoping for the next breakthrough. And it was energizing, and I was young, and it was terrific, and I was on the fast track. But somewhere, just because I'm a drunk, You know, I found alcohol. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad was a blackout drinker. Both my brothers are alcoholics. And I swore I would never be like them. So my effort to not be like them was to not drink, because the only people I knew got drunk when they drank. And bad things happened. So my auntie, who was a rocket scientist, because she really was, she worked at NACA and NASA, and was involved in the space program. And she had this thing where she would drink a 2-ounce martini, and that was it. Or she'd have a glass of wine. And that perplexed me, because I'd never seen anybody drink anything ever and not just continue to drink. So when I hit 21, because she was a single woman and had extra money, and so she ate well and dined well, we went out to dinner one evening, as we usually did, and I decided I'd have a glass of wine. It was a really nice, fine vintage Cabernet. I can to this day tell you that the first sip of that was like a light switch went off. It felt warm going down. I actually liked the taste of it, unlike some people. It had a nice body to it. It was dry. It had a nice nose. It was terrific. And if that's all I ever drank, I could have been just like her. Unfortunately, what would happen is we'd go to dinner and we'd order a half a bottle of wine, and that's a split, and there are 2.5 glasses in that, if they're properly poured. And she'd drink a glass and I'd finish the bottle. And it wasn't too long before we'd order a bottle. And she'd have a glass and I'd finish the bottle. And I had no off button. And then I discovered what some people referred to as my drink of choice. It's nonsense. Outside of gin, which I'm physically allergic to in a way that makes me go into anaphylactic shock. Other than that, there's every bit of alcohol. If you'd given me grain alcohol, I did try some Gallo. I wasn't impressed. But I would drink it if I needed that ease that alcohol always brought me. But I fell in love with vodka, and it wasn't until I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that I realized that people have views on vodka. I listened to a speaker one time stand at the podium, and this person had a lot of time, and she said, "And I knew I was an alcoholic when I started drinking vodka." And I heard another say, "And I knew I wasn't an alcoholic because I hadn't started drinking vodka." So it wasn't until I came here that I realized my vodka drinking really was an indication, if I had needed one, that I was an alcoholic. And I drank vodka. And the truth is, when I was working in high tech, that was terrific, because after coming home and the brain just going as fast as it could, and I needed to slow down and rest because I needed a little bit of sleep before I got up and did it all again, and I wasn't doing any of that stuff that I did in college, that, you know, so I needed something. And what I found was that if I had some vodka, it would slow me down enough and I could get a good night's sleep, good 3 or 4 hours, and then I could get up and work. Truth is that the way I drank that vodka is very alcoholic as well, because I started by downing a single and then nursing a single. And it wasn't too long before I downed a double and then nursed a single. And then I downed a double and nursed a double, and then I don't know, it just got lost in there. By the time I got to the rooms, I was drinking a half gallon of vodka every day. And how do you do that and not black out? Because I'm not a blackout drinker. And the answer is, if you drink 2 to 4 ounces every 2 hours or so, you can maintain a completely functional drunken state of being. And people will leave you alone because they never see any difference in you. And you learn how to talk, so you're only slurring most of the time. And you learn how to walk, so you're only wiggly some of the time. And you don't get tickets, and you avoid the law. I met a man when I was working in high tech. who, when I saw him walk across the manufacturing floor, I said, I want to have his children. And that's kind of the way my thinking goes. And the reason I said that is because he had red hair. And I have this thing about people with red hair. And he and I decided that sounded like a good idea, so we got married. And we had this beautiful red-haired daughter. And just about the time that I was getting ready to come in here, she was 8. She was suicidal. And her life was really black. And I knew that what that was like because when I was growing up in the chaos of the home I grew up in, I too had had those thoughts of, wouldn't it just be better if I weren't here? So I didn't want her to go through that pain. So I did the only thing an appropriate Northern California modern person could do, and I took my daughter to the child psychologist. And she'd been seeing her for almost a year. And sometime in August, probably right around now, I got called in at noon for a session. And I figured at this point, I was going to get the plan of how to fix him so my daughter wasn't suffering. And I sat down and the psychologist looked at me and said, your daughter shows all the signs of growing up in an alcoholic home. And I went, I don't see how that's possible. No one in our house drinks. And I meant it. Because that's how. I didn't drink the way my dad did. I didn't drink the way my brother did. I'm not a blackout drinker. I don't have DUIs. I haven't spent time in jail. How could I be drinking? I'm just taking the edge off. So we sat and talked for about 45 minutes about the nature of denial and how that's defined. And I went home, and I was so angry at that woman for having the nerve to suggest that I was an alcoholic. So I poured every bit of alcohol I could find into a juice pitcher. I think I had 5 ice cubes or 6 in the refrigerator, and I threw those in. And I sat in my favorite chair, drinking out of the juice pitcher, complaining about this woman calling me an alcoholic. And I went to bed, and I woke up the next morning, and two things were really, really clear to me. One, that the alcohol that had always filled up that big empty hole in my heart, that God-shaped hole that had always been empty and painful and just always there, that was still there. The alcohol hadn't filled it up the night before. And at that moment, I realized that I too, like my father, was an alcoholic. So I did the only thing I knew how to do. I called central office, and I did that because my great uncle, my dad's uncle, had been an early member of Alcoholics Anonymous in Denver, where I grew up. And when he passed away in the 80s, he had 40-plus years of continuous sobriety. So I knew it worked for somebody. I didn't know if he'd been as bad as I was. But I called central office. And the guy at central office, I said to him, you know, I really need to go to a meeting. And he said, well, there's one at noon on Blackford Road today. And I said, well, I don't want to go today. And he said, well, there's one at noon tomorrow on Blackford Road. And I said, well, I really don't want to go tomorrow. Now, the guy on the other end of the phone, I later came to find out, is named New York John. And New York John has a particular attitude that comes because he's from New York. And so he asked me when I wanted to go. And I think, just knowing John, he probably had a few New York words spiced in there just to make sure that I understood he was confused by me. And so I thought about it for a moment, and I said, Tuesday. Now, I cannot tell you why I picked Tuesday. I guess I thought maybe another day or two, and maybe I'd change my mind. I don't know. I said Tuesday. So he said, on Blackford Road at noon. So I showed up there, and I should have had a hint, because I drove into the parking lot and there were 50 motorcycles. And because it was also a continuation school, my little brain didn't go, you idiot, this is a motorcycle meeting. It went, oh, look, all those continuation students have transportation. Which, of course, they didn't. They walked to school. But so I walk into this room, and here's a room full of mostly men. There are a few women, but mostly men, in their leathers and their chains and their tattoos and their stories about time in San Quentin and Chino and Folsom and other places, doing things that I hadn't even read about in magazines. And it made me a little nervous. And then I looked up, and the speaker that day was Little Tiny Nun. And her name is Bonnie Rock. And Bonnie would be fine with me using both her names because she uses them when she speaks as well. And the thing that's interesting about Bonnie, pardon me while I drink, is that she's not only an ex-nun, she's also a retired nurse. My mom was a nurse, and Bonnie and she had worked together, and so I had met her at some of the dinner parties that my mom had thrown. Bonnie drank and was at the end of her drinking career, just at the point I was starting mine. Pardon me, my allergies. And I looked at her, and I thought, oh my God, if she can get sober, maybe, just maybe, there's hope for me. And I walked out of that meeting with a big book and a sponsor and a little bit of hope, just a little bit. And my sponsor asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths to get and stay sober. And I said yes, because I had no idea of what that meant, and I had no idea of what the journey would look like, but I was broken. And I was broken because in that realization that I too was an alcoholic, I realized that yet again I was not enough. I grew up my whole life never being enough. I wasn't pretty enough. I wasn't tall enough. I wasn't rich enough, I wasn't smart enough, I just was never enough. And here I was, yet again, not enough. And so my sponsor asked me to call her in the morning at 9 o'clock, and I explained to her I had this busy social schedule because I was volunteering at school and I had all these things I needed to do, and she said, well, I guess you don't want to get sober, and turned around and started to walk away. And of course, this is that first moment when I thought, you bitch. And so I ran after her and I said, don't you understand? And she said, I understand perfectly. If you want to get sober, call me at 9 a.m. And somehow in that busy social schedule, which previously had included a lot of drinking, I managed to find a phone and call her. And that started a journey for us through these 12 steps that changed my life. And what I didn't understand, because I heard it at every meeting and it made me want to throw up, was that all I needed to do was just keep coming back, don't drink, it will change. And those three things have been the core of my sobriety. Now, I will tell you, none of that would have happened if I didn't work the steps. All that change and coming back and not drinking wasn't possible without working the steps. That's where I found my relief. But what I found was that about every day, my sponsor had had me do something, and I was driving her to meetings because I thought I was being oh so magnanimous because she was new to the area and didn't know it that well, and I was going to show her where these places were because I'd lived there for so long. And turns out she had a GPS system and a road map and knew where everything was anyway. And I didn't find that out till I was 3 years sober. So that tells you that though I was in high tech and I might be really smart, I'm clueless. So we'd sit and talk as I'd drive to meetings, and she'd always have me doing something. And the second day we went to meetings, she said, "It's time for you to be in service." So she got me a coffee duty. And I either made coffee or set up at every meeting that I've ever attended in California. Your chairs are already set up, so I don't have to do that here, but I frequently make coffee. I sat in the front row and listened to people, because some folks are sicker than others, and I'm one of those that needs to be able to, I see you. And I needed to see the speaker and hear the speaker. And in California, we stand when we share. And one of the reasons we do that is because if you're a drunk like me, I spend all my time sitting in my chair telling stories, none of which are true. And I tend to drink when I do that. So standing up helps me remember that I need to tell the truth, and I need to be where my feet are in the here and now. And it helps you because you can see my face and you can see my eyes, and so you can find out what's going on with me. These are things that I came to understand later. I just figured I was a whiz kid because, being a smart person, you know, I knew the book, because as soon as I read it, it just stuck in my little head, and I could quote it chapter and verse, thank you very much. And I was as obnoxious as they come. I was a 30-day wonder. I was one of those people that you just want to take outside and back of the meeting hall and just beat the ever-loving crap out of. And the fact that people did not do that to me is, in retrospect, an amazement. Because here's the truth of it. I can tell you what the words are, and that has nothing to do with anything. What I discovered over time is there's a difference between what I know up here and what I feel in here. And there's a difference between being able to spout the book and to talk the language of the heart. Fortunately for me, the old timers in the room would pat me on the head and they'd say, just keep coming back, don't drink, and get in service. And I go, oh God, I'm so tired of hearing that. And it didn't matter if it was a good day or a bad day. You know, that daughter of mine went through teenage years, and it was really tough because she was a cutter and an anorexic. And her dad and I at the time were going through a really, really nasty divorce. And that first year of sobriety for me was really, really hard because I had a recurrence of a really life-threatening health condition. And so those first 3 years of sobriety for me just looked horrible. And there were times that I'd just shake my fist at God and go, I'm living out of my van. My kid is killing herself. I'm not having any fun. I'm desperate. Is this why you got me sober? And while I don't hear God's voice audibly, it came to me in a sense of knowing that, yeah, this is one of the reasons I got you sober. So when people tell me they're having tough times in their sobriety, I go, yeah, sometimes life really sucks and it's really hard and my heart really hurts and I don't have to drink today. Today, I don't have to drink. At the time, I didn't appreciate that for what it meant. Almost 18 years later, I can tell you it amazes me I didn't drink those times. But I sat in meetings and I shared when people would ask me what was going on in my life. And I shared not only the problem, but the solution. And I got into service and I put the plug in the jug and I just kept coming back. And I had edges on me and sharpness on me that just cut everybody and everything I ran into. I mean, my good friend Charles Adams describes knowing me in my early sobriety was like hugging a porcupine. And it was, because not only was I smart, but being smart and basically an a-hole, I was opinionated. So if I didn't agree with your interpretation of the book, or something you said at meeting level, it's not like I would gently take you aside after the meeting and suggest something different. I engaged in what they call crosstalk, which is speaking out loud from my chair when not called upon, saying things that really hurt other people's feelings. And I thought that was perfectly okay. And I will tell you that I thought that was perfectly okay until one year when I was 10 years sober and I had a newcomer in tears and an old timer pulled me aside and said, "You've done that so often and I don't know why you think that's okay. You have to cut that out." And I thought, well, how rude of you. And then I had another old-timer pull me aside and say, "I've watched you for 10 years, and if you think this is what sobriety's about, you may as well go drink." And I had another old-timer pull me aside and say, real clear, just in case I was confused, "You need to cut that shit out." This woman had 40 years of sobriety when she passed away last year, and she was one of my dearest friends. All of those kindnesses that the old-timers taught me, and maybe it's because I was 10 years sober, hit me like a bombshell. And shortly thereafter, I found that that dangerous health situation that I thought I had beaten was back yet again. And all of a sudden, it meant something to me about how I interacted with people and what the world thought of me and what my daily life looked like. And at 10 years sober, yet again, I was broken. And the wheels of my life had come off. I hadn't had a drink, but I wasn't sober in the sense of being emotionally sober. It's what the 12 and 12 talks about when it talks about steps 8 and 9. Emotional sobriety. Are we in right relation with God and our fellows? Do I do the right thing? Am I compassionate to those, not just in the rooms, but to everyone in my life? And I looked at that, and I had lots of friends in AA. Lots of people knew me. I could walk into any room and people would call my name. I spoke lots of places. And I could quote the book as solid as anybody in the room. I don't quote the book so much anymore. And it's not because I don't believe in it. But the things that I quote are the things that will keep me sober. The things that I quote are the things that will keep you sober. They're simple things. Like, for me to drink is to die. Wow. Whoever knew that? I'm restless, irritable, and discontented. By my very nature, that's what I am. It describes me. It is the ism of the alcoholic. I, self, me. I came in here selfish, self-centered, driven by 100 forms of fear. I knew all the answers, and my life was a total wreck. And what happened is the steps gave me a way out. They didn't change my life, but my willingness to do the work that's involved in the steps, and then to be willing to sit here with you in meetings and have you change my life, because I didn't change it. The truth of the matter is my behavior was so unacceptable, so intolerable, so unlovable, and yet there you were. You accepted me, you loved me, you tolerated me. You never said, "Get out, we don't want you." What you said was, "Don't take a drink, just keep coming back and do service." And I still hated that. And when my 15-year-old daughter quit talking to me because she had had enough smothering, because I was trying to make up for 8 years lost, so I just got real involved in her life, and I was going to make her life perfect, even though her folks were going through one of the nastiest divorces you could ever go through. Took us 7.5 years to complete that divorce. And it's not because I was fighting. In fact, I just show up at court. I didn't have an attorney. Every time the court said something he didn't like, he'd change attorneys, and then we'd start all over again. 7.5 years. And then the reason it ended is because I signed the papers because our daughter was out of high school and nothing would have mattered anyway. It was all done. What? How in the world did I do that without drinking? I can't explain that to you, except that I sat in the rooms, and when my heart was breaking, when my 15-year-old quit talking to me because she was sick of mom, and rightfully so, and told me she would never, ever see me again. And so going from seeing her every day, taking her to school, making sure she was fed, and then taking her back home to her dad's house every single day, there was nothing. There was no phone call. There was no trip to pick her up and take her to school. No trip to school to pick her up and take her home. No fixing her food. There was nothing. And my heart broke. And I was in so much pain. And I would stand. And a lot of times it was at women's meetings. Not because I don't like to share with the gentlemen, but I don't like to cry in front of guys. I just don't. For me, it's a sign of weakness. Doesn't bother me so much anymore. But in those days, I would stand and share. And sometimes I could only get a sentence or two out, and then I'd have to sit down because I didn't want to cry in front of the very people who cared about me the most. Because I was afraid it was a sign of weakness. And people would come up to me after the meetings and they'd go, you know, I went through something like that with my 15-year-old or my 20-year-old or my 8-year-old. And it's okay. It will change. And I'd go, no, she's her mother's daughter. I know her well. It will never change. And they'd go, and that's okay too. Just don't drink. Keep coming back and get into service. And so I kept coming back, and I just didn't drink, and I got into yet more service. And then there was that period of time, during that period of time, where it seemed like I was nothing but service. And then my mom, in the latter years of her life, got really sick. And I became her full-time caregiver. Now, she lived in Fresno at that point, which is a 2.5-hour drive from San Jose. And I made that every single morning and came back every single night until the last 6 months of her life. And during that time, the woman who told me that I was an alcoholic or that my daughter was growing up in an alcoholic home. During that time, she told me the quality of my sobriety would improve if I could learn to forgive my mom. And, you know, I said, there are a lot of reasons why that's not going to happen. And I said, right now, I'm neutral. And it's not about forgiveness. I mean, we're going along fine. I'm taking care of her. It's, you know, life goes on. Forgiveness is God's job. And so in the taking care of my mom for the last 2.5 years of her life, and in giving to her what I wished I'd had as a child, and in doing for her what hadn't been done for me, forgiveness came. And it's not because I sought it. It's because I was doing for someone else. And I was doing just because it was the right thing to do. I wasn't looking for anything. I was doing it just because. And I was doing it because I was sober. And I was doing it because I knew it was the right thing to do. And the forgiveness came. And when she passed away, I spent the day with her, singing her favorite songs, saying her favorite prayers, and she peacefully went. By now, my daughter was at least talking to me some of the time. And so we got to share that moment as I went to pick her up from high school, because Mom waited until I left before she decided to leave, which is the way she always was. And what a gift that was, because no words were left unspoken. We knew where each other was, and there was healing that I had never thought would come. And that softened my heart. And so as the years have gone on, what I have found is that all those hard edges that kept all of you away have been smoothed out, just because I keep bumping into people, kind of like a rock tumbler. The slurry just keeps taking the edges off. And then at 11 years sober, I stood and I collected my chip, and I was speaking that night at my home group, and I looked around and there were 70 people in the room, all of whom had come to dinner with me, and they knew how sick I was, and they came to hear me and they came to share with me. And I stood up, and there wasn't a newcomer in the room, so I didn't give my usual "you don't have to drink today" routine. And I stood there and I spoke for all of about 4 minutes. And all I could do was weep and sob in the process and thank them all for my sobriety and for what they taught me in life and for the meaning they had given to my life. Because without these steps, none of those people would have been sober. And without these steps, I wouldn't have been sober. And particularly that 12th step, where we practice these principles in all our affairs. Not just in these rooms, every aspect of my life. And so I sobbed my way through that, and the topic was gratitude, which I swore I would never make as a topic, because nothing is more irritating than listening to Janora Lavelle say, "Hi, my name's Janora, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic." Heard that at my first meeting, heard it at the last meeting just before I came to Georgia, and it was a joy. Gratitude for me is an action, but I also have a gratitude list, and it's the same one I wrote when I was being snarky with my sponsor and she told me to write one. He said, "Okay, fine, 5 things. I was grateful I had both my arms and legs. I was grateful for a roof over my head. I was grateful for hot and cold running water. I was grateful I had transportation. And I was grateful that I had food." And she said, "That's a perfect list. I want you to put that on a 3x5 card and look at that every morning before you say the third step prayer and every evening before you thank him for your sobriety." And I said, "So how long do I do that?" And she said, "Until..." And this morning I looked at that 3x5 card before I said the third step prayer. And I looked at it last night before I said thank you for my sobriety. You know, the truth of the matter is, when I was living out of my van, I was grateful to have a roof over my head. I was grateful to know where the YMCA and the McDonald's and the all-night Denny's were. I was grateful for those things in a way that I can't explain. Today I'm grateful for those things because it gives me perspective. And at almost 18 years sober, I have perspective. And what I know is, you're stuck with me for at least another 24 hours, because today is not my day. Tomorrow might be, but I get today, and I'm going to make the most of it. I get a chance to be sober and a living example of the Big Book. Some people are never going to know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous at all, but they will know something about me and how I lead my life as a recovered alcoholic, recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And yet here I am, a fully functional adult, well, semi-functional. And why in the world would I come to Georgia after spending so much time living and getting sober in Northern California? Well, not only did my daughter finally talk to me again, but we started developing a really close relationship. I sent her off to school to go to school at Savannah College of Art and Design, and within the first month there, she called home and said, I'm changing majors, and I'm going to Dahlonega. And I said, okay. She's a brilliant artist, but as so many of her teachers at SCAD said, you're too smart to be here. She still does her artwork. But she went to the University of North Georgia, North Georgia College and State University. That's what it was called then. It's, I guess, UNG these days. She went to Dahlonega to study nursing. And, you know, she met and fell in love with one of your fine Georgia boys. And he is a fine young man. He has a lot of her dad in him. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I'm sure that's part of what attracted her. And they got married on the day she graduated. And I got a chance to see that. I got a chance to pin her nursing pin on her. And my heart was so full of joy for her. And I knew my mom was looking down, just as happy as she could be. And so when I got laid off of my last job, which in high tech you get laid off every now and then, and the job market in California didn't look too good, so my daughter said, well, why don't you just take early retirement and come out here? We've got a place for you. And so I thought about that for a few months, and that's what happened. So last May 28th, I headed out on the road to end up here in Georgia. And I still have a few bills to pay, so when I'm done here, I'll go home and take a nap and then go over and do some retail work for the rest of my day. So I do still work a little bit. But you know, in all of those things, because my daughter is a nurse, and what happened is that her husband is an engineer. And being a male engineer, he's very linear in his thinking. And she's a gerontologist, so she deals with people who are ill and elderly. And when she would have difficult times, she would talk to him about the patient she'd lost or the difficulty that they had. And he'd say, they're old, they're sick, they're going to die. Why are you surprised? Now, it's completely understandable because it's the most logical thing there is. And that's not really quite what she was asking for. And so she learned to call me on the phone. And we would have these wonderful discussions. And it's like the first night that she had to call a code. And she called, and it had to be 1 or 2 o'clock Georgia time. And all I heard was the deep intake of breath and the catch in her voice. And the first 5 minutes, all she could do was sob. She couldn't get a word out. And I didn't have to say a word. I just sat and let her be with it, and I could be with her. And I learned how to do that here. You people taught me how to do that. I didn't have to fix it. I could honor it. I could treat it for the sacred thing it was. And that night, she had to call her first code. And she cracked the ribs of the woman that she was doing heartbeats on. And that's hard when you're dealing with a little tiny frail 92-year-old. And then there was a time that she called me, and there were a lot of times they were just fun conversations. And there was a time that she called, and she was kind of chuckling, and I said, so what happened this evening? And she said, oh, you'll love this one, Mom. Mrs. A was at the end of the hall, and she's calling out, going, help me, I've gone blind. Will somebody please help me? And so my daughter walks to the end of the hall and looks in the door, and she said, Mrs. A, open your eyes. Alzheimer's hospice unit, not everybody's all there. And again, Mrs. A calls out and says, help me. Oh, God, won't somebody help me, please? I've gone blind. And so my daughter says, I'm going to stroke your cheek now. And so she walks across the room and strokes the woman's cheeks. And Mrs. A reaches out, grasps her wrist, and says, oh, thank God. You know, I was blind and couldn't see. And I loved that story. We both had a good chuckle over it. I mean, I want everybody to have that level of care. But that story sat in my mind for 2 weeks. And finally at a meeting I was called on, and we were talking once again about gratitude. And that story came back to me. That's my life in AA. So frequently, I am blind and I cannot see. And you touch me and my eyes open. And that's a moment of grace for me, which always reminds me of the wonderful hymn, "Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost and now I'm found, was blind and now I see." Thank you all for being here today. I can't stay sober without you.